Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
I'm Adrian Marinello.
And today we will discuss how the tech sector is evolving in China, with a particular focus on the current regulatory and big tech crackdown wave, which we've seen in the past few months. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China, as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today from San Francisco is Rui Ma. With 15 years of experience in technology and finance, she will help us navigate these troubled waters. In 2018, Rui Ma started TechBuds China to educate investors, funds, and entrepreneurs on Chinese tech companies with original insights and research. So she's particularly well-placed to tell us more about all this. Hello, Rui Ma. How are you?
Hi, everyone. I'm really pleased to be here today.
Thanks a lot for joining us from San Francisco. Today, we are again recording an episode across different time zones, from the west coast of the USA to continental Europe to Taipei. I have to admit that for me and Mario, being on the Brussels timing, we are particularly challenged by the early morning. It's 6 a.m. over here. So please cope with us. We will need some extra doses of caffeine during our discussion. Also, this is what makes the beauty of The Sound of Economics as a truly global podcasting experience. But back to our topic of conversations. So, in the past episode, we've explored the waves of regulations linked to the new common prosperity mantra by the Chinese Communist Party. And we already mentioned that a wave of regulations is touching the digital sector, from gaming platforms to GDPR-looking privacy regulations to a draft regulation cracking down on recommendation algorithms. On the other hand, we've seen as well a wave of crackdowns on big tech, from Jack Ma of Alibaba to the case of Didi. Rui Ma, could you help us understanding what is going on? I would like to start really first on the regulatory aspect, as some of these regulations might seem even more radical than what we've been used to with in the European Union. And it would be interesting for our audience to understand more.
Sure, I can do that. So I think in general, the easiest framework I found, and maybe it's a little bit of an oversimplification, but I like to separate the regulations to three basic buckets. And that's just because I think there are just so many regulations, right? Unless we categorize them, you end up just having this very, very long list. I think the easiest way to think about it is to separate them to Chinese idiosyncratic, and then keeping up with the West. And the third one's what I would call standard setting for new emerging technology. So let me explain what that means. By the first bucket, which I just call Chinese idiosyncratic, it's sort of a catch-all for everything that the government has put out that is really China-specific. It's really have no standards in the developed world that they're trying to mimic, and it's not really about new emerging technologies. So it could be a result of different social norms, the role of the state, right? Obviously, China's government operates differently from the West. Or it could be reactions to very China-specific issues. And right now in China, there are some sort of urgent crises, what I would call the demographic crisis, right? The rapid aging of the technology, declining fertility, as well as things like the choke point technologies, right? Reacting to the trade war, things like that. China-specific problems. And in this bucket, I would put in one regulation which really shocked everyone, which is the decimation, the destruction of the after-school tutoring sector, where the Chinese government effectively made it into a nonprofit sector overnight, right? Or implementing gaming restrictions for minors so that children cannot play more than 3 hours of video games per week, right? These I'm not sure, but these, I think, might be some of the regulations you're talking about that are very quote unquote harsh, right? But these are really China specific, and they're really reacting to a local phenomenon. The second bucket is what I would call keeping up with the West. So Chinese regulations that are trying to catch up, in effect, to what developed countries already have in place. So they could be, by the way, also rectifications of previous regulatory gaps, or they're just updating the rules so they can be conforming to what the rest of the world has. So an example of rectification of a previous gap might be the fintech rules that put forth against Ant Group in particular, the Alibaba affiliate that has all the payment and fintech products. Basically, you know, Ant was allowed to have these very generous ways of getting credit that really shouldn't be allowed. So this was a regulatory gap, and the regulators rectified it. Another example might be updating rules, right? So they conform to Western standards, which would be the antitrust and data privacy, data security rules, where you can find like actually traces of European law, US law, et cetera. They might have some variations, but they're largely in line. And the third thing is the standard setting for new technology. So these are new emerging technologies that the rest of the world's also trying to figure out what to do. And China wants to get ahead of the world and start putting rules forward, right? It has a very large market. So it's hoping, I think, that when it puts these rules forward, that by being first, you know, again, combined with immense market power, they can set a precedent and sort of carve out a trajectory for future regulations in these sectors. So China really wants to take a leadership role in standard setting going forward, right? They've been very explicit about this. They don't want to, you know, keep on catching up to the West. They want to have a say in what the global rules are going to be. And this is what the third bucket is. And into that bucket, I would put things like the recommendation algorithms, right? That other countries haven't necessarily started regulating. China has now a 3-year plan for algorithm governance, things like that. That's what I would put in that third bucket. And I think those three buckets can largely capture pretty much all of the regulations that have come out, with the exception of maybe things like, you know, I think crypto might be one of the things that don't fit neatly into these buckets.
Thank you. This is a very, very clear overview, and it's very helpful. I'm sure that Mario would like to react on this overview.
I just wanted to say that I find this classification very useful. Thank you, Rima. Although, maybe, I mean, like, it's at least, I mean, like, if I see it from a European point of view, I find it sometimes hard maybe to define clear boundaries between the three categories, because there are a lot of overlaps somehow. For example, from a European perspective, you could think about the artificial intelligence proposed regulation that now is with the European Union legislators to be discussed. Well, that's indeed a little bit of a mix, no? Standard setting, your third category. You want to be a first mover in this space, of course, to put the world in the direction somehow that we think that is the best. But is also very much about dealing with problems that we see are idiosyncratic to the European market. We see increasing risks, for example, in the workplace to which the European workforce is subject to. So, I mean, like, you know, what is this? I mean, like, it's the first bucket or the third bucket. I don't know, really. And maybe, I mean, like, it's a little bit the same also in the Chinese market. You can't really completely distinguish them. So, but anyway, I mean, like, it's useful from a didactic point of view. Yeah, I mean, like, if you could maybe, I mean, I go a little bit further in the discussion of this algorithm crackdown, because that's, I mean, from our point of view is indeed quite extreme. I mean, like to basically tell technological companies how they use the algorithm. Here is a little bit, you know, I mean, we consider that, of course, as something extremely invasive, in, if you want. I mean, the algorithm at the end of the day is at the core of the business models on many technological companies. So how was this taken in China from the technological sector? Is it like, I mean, you know, perceived as going very much too far, I mean, like if you want, and how do you think the sector can cope with it?
So what I would say is right now, I think the algorithm rules are largely still in draft, right? And the 3-year plan for algorithm governance, that's actually quite rough. But what I can tell you is that there is already a lot of industry feedback on some of the writing, right? So even though it's very ambiguous, but for example, one line in particular, I think caught the notice of a lot of practitioners, which is that it said algorithms must be submitted for approval, is how I would roughly translate it, which a lot of practitioners looked at that line and said, well, that makes no sense. Algorithms are changing so quickly. And also what exactly are you proving, right? Like in terms of the code, or are you looking at the results? And if I have to approve each time I make a change to the algorithm, then I can't really function as a business, right? So as you said, maybe you could consider that quite invasive or just doesn't make too much sense. What I would say is that I think there's some hope that these guidelines, first of all, are not yet set in stone. So they are draft documents. They're open for comments from practitioners. And if we are to go by what some of the other tech regulations, the process has been, is that the government does take into account feedback from the industry. So hopefully things that are very difficult to execute or maybe don't particularly make that much sense will get removed from the final conclusion. But I do think overall there is this, I think in society, there is general support for algorithm regulation because there is the sense that algorithms are so much a part of the average citizens' everyday lives, and there is not enough transparency on the part of the companies. So e-commerce, for example, actually already had from, I think, 2017, where the platforms already had to make it clear how they were tagging each user, and users had to be given the right to be able to remove those tags, right? So there is already some attempt to push towards algorithmic transparency, but in the past, it was just for one type of product, and now there is the push for more and more, right? It's not just going to be for shopping, but it's going to be for, you know, my social media or when I order food or whatever it is.
If I may jump on this, because I'm very intrigued to understand this regulation, at least even if it's on a draft stage, it has a part which is more classic kind of state control approach. But it has also a user-centric approach, if I understand correctly. I mean, there is a power of the user in order to control more what the algorithm is providing to this user. Is that part of this regulation? I think this will be very interesting to understand for our listeners.
Yes, absolutely. It's basically giving much more. So I think with algorithms, you can think of it as explaining the algorithm. So algorithms are generally black boxes to most of us users. Sometimes it is, by the way, black boxes even to the platforms. But there is a lot of pressure for the companies to be able to explain exactly what their algorithms are doing, and then for users to control how the algorithms interact with them in their lives. That is absolutely a huge part of the algorithm regulations that are being contemplated right now. And that is the direction of governance. And I think, you know, if you left it up to the average user to advocate this for themselves, I think if you were just, you know, to take a microphone up to some person on the street and ask them if they would like control, they would, of course, like it. But I think it's actually very difficult for most of us who are not technical to articulate what we really want and need, right? So I think, at least in China, the average citizen's happy for the government to take the lead on this and push this through.
Alicia, do you want to add something on the regulatory part?
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's of course intriguing and interesting that, you know, the society feels they don't have the capacity or the knowledge and therefore give that right to the government to do for them. But if you push that further, I'm afraid you go very, very far. And I'm sure you understand what I mean. And if not, I'm going to clarify. So, you know, this is not only about data sovereignty, it's about algorithm sovereignty. You know, so if I hear you correctly, what it really means, and again, we could talk about data as well, as you know, the requirements for companies with more than 1 million users and what it does, what it means for those companies in terms of surrendering the data. I mean, if I put all of that together, I wonder whether it is really all of these regulations have the objective of protecting the user rather than accumulating data for the government. And I just want to hear your views about this, because I don't think it's enough to say that people can't know what they need, but rather why the government takes that on board for them. I mean, I'd like to hear your views. Is this a very paternalistic model in terms of data and algorithms, or is it more than that?
I think for the algorithms, again, I don't think it's that clear yet, because it is fairly preliminary. What I can say is, for the data security, there's pretty clear carve-outs for what the government has access to, right? So it's actually the government is kind of accepted from a lot of these rules. And the rules are, in fact, really to protect the consumer from the corporations. And again, this is maybe like something that is idiosyncratic about the Chinese population. But in general, if you ask like a Chinese citizen what they're most concerned about, they are actually most concerned about, they're more, I would say, relatively more concerned about their data being abused by corporations, because I think they just sort of take it as a given that the state will have data on them. So the regulations, for the most part, really are to restrict the rights of corporations. And I think, again, taking anecdotal, I'm not an expert, right? So I can sort of only take what the media has reported and also what I've personally experienced and, you know, what my friends in China have experienced, which is that because there was very little legal oversight on how corporations could use this data, and because the regulations were lagging, right? Remember, there's that whole central bucket of needing to catch up to the developed economies. There was, in fact, a lot of abuse by corporations of your data. So it was very common to have your data be sold and resold to many other vendors who may be calling you up for loans or trying to get you to use their pawn shop or whatever it is without your permission. And it was very, very bad in China, right? In fact, spam was such a problem in China that that's often cited as the main reason why Alan Zhang created WeChat. It was actually really to stop the overflow of spam and your information, your phone number, your name being sold everywhere. Unfortunately, it's taken, I think, until the last few years for the government to really do something about it. But the regulations, again, if you look at it, are primarily about restricting the corporations, and it does not really address, the state, because there are exceptions made for national security, which my understanding is that it's quite broad, without being, a policy expert, but that's my understanding.
The other aspect we would like to delve more in this episode is the crackdown on big tech. You just mentioned that somehow the target of this regulation is primarily corporations. So we've grown accustomed in here in Europe to conflicts between tech giants, especially the United States-based ones, and EU competition law. Less we know what is going on in China, and Didi and Alibaba cases, which popped out on headlines in international newspapers, seems just to be the beginning or the tip of an iceberg that is going on over there. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, sure. So those are two pretty different cases, and I think they illustrate completely different aspects of the regulations, right? So the Alibaba case, well, first of all, if we are to count Ant Group as one of them, I already mentioned earlier, Ant Group is sort of the spinoff from Alibaba that has all the payment products and fintech products. That had a completely different regulation, which was regarding, you know, its ability to lend and get access to credit and how it was to be regulated more as a banking entity going forward. That is separate. When people talk about Alibaba, they're primarily talking about the antitrust regulation. So Alibaba was fined for violating what's called two choose one, which is that they were forcing their vendors to their merchants to be exclusive on their platform. So they would punish you if you, for example, also try to sell on a competing platform like JD, for example. And this is obviously very, very hurtful to all merchants, but especially to small businesses, right? Who you know, don't have a large budget and might really need to be on multiple platforms to just survive. But the antitrust rules, really actually also protect against discriminatory pricing, against, you know, unauthorized bundling, and then made it very explicit that VIE entities, which is a form of legal structure that almost all internet companies in China are from under, are not exempt from monopolies, because China had anti-monopoly law for the past decade. It's just largely not enforced against internet companies because those VIEs had this sort of gray area. And then there was nothing explicit about these behaviors that I mentioned, to choose one, discriminatory pricing, et cetera. So for Alibaba, that's what happened. And they were fined a percentage of their last year's revenues. They were actually fined almost $3 billion. And that's like the largest fine that's ever been levied against a company in China. For antitrust purposes. For Didi, that's a completely different situation, where Didi right now, it's under investigation and it has been punished because its apps have been pulled from app stores, but it has not yet been fined. The investigation has not yet concluded. And what it's under investigation for is misuse of personal information. Now, a lot of people, including myself, think that it was really because they went ahead with their US IPO without getting explicit permission from the government. In fact, it is rumored, and I think it's largely now been confirmed, that the government asked them not to go ahead with the IPO because they were concerned about the vast amounts of citizen data, sensitive data that they had. And they didn't want the company to list abroad and be subject to maybe investigations or data queries from a foreign government. But Didi decided to go ahead with this IPO anyway, and then was promptly, like I said, punished by having this investigation launched against them and having their apps be removed from app stores. We don't know yet what the final result will be for that investigation. But I think for Alibaba, you can see it as very, very similar to most other antitrust cases we have, right? It's a very clear violation. But for Didi, that is a very China-specific situation where the government is concerned about data security. And I don't think you can really find too much of an analog in other cases yet.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Thank you, Roma. No, it seems that there are lots of similarities with what we are seeing here in Europe, of course. I mean, if you take this Alibaba case, somehow it echoes cases that we have seen here. Think about the Most Favored Nation clause and the booking.com saga. But the thing is, here somehow there is an acknowledgement that ex post antitrust enforcement is probably not enough to address all the issues that we are seeing popping up. And so we are in the process of moving a bit of the battle on these issues from an ex post setting to an ex ante regulation. What is called the Digital Market Act is basically that. It's about taking lessons from all these cases that we had in antitrust enforcement, and acknowledge the fact that antitrust is not moving as fast as it should to address the issues in these dynamic markets, and establishing some certain rules, like in this case could be, allow business users to offer the same product or services to end users through third-party online intermediation services at price or conditions that are different from those offered through the online intermediation service of the gatekeeper. I'm just reading one of the provision of the DMA, the draft DMA, which sounds to me like would match the issue that you mentioned for Alibaba. So the question is, do you think that China is on the same path somehow? I mean, do you have the feeling that the Chinese authorities will realize that antitrust ex post enforcement will not be enough, and there will be like the need to have a more ex ante approach, establishing certain rules with its own risks, right? Because when you do that, I mean, you risk to maybe go too far and dissuade companies from engaging in pro-competitive behavior. So do you think that there will be some attempts in that direction also in China or not?
I think they're definitely aware of it. I'm not sure exactly where the government's going, but I'm very sure they're aware of it. And the reason why I'm very sure is because I actually went and talked to, I forget his name exactly, but he was part of the antitrust like policy center. I'm messing up the name, but something like that, where because I interviewed him and I wanted to understand when did China start thinking about antitrust against digital platforms. And this institute, which works very closely with regulators, was like, first of all, it has a lot of members from Europe. So the lawyer I talked to was actually from Europe, but his point was that they've been working on this for several years, so 3 to 4 years before it was actually announced. And it's widely known in antitrust circles that fines, or as you said, ex post enforcement, right, of these misbehaviors is not actually very useful, right? We see pretty much like Google, Facebook, they're getting fined every year or so, like $1 billion or $3 billion. And it's not really stopping, or it's not having the market dynamics change in the way that the government really actually wants, right? More equal playing field, more innovation, et cetera. So I'm very sure they're aware of this issue. I do think that there is a tendency to go for these, very large fines because it makes everyone feel good and makes everyone feel like they've done something, right? Really important versus this very risky ex ante regulation, which requires a lot more thinking. And maybe people are like, well, nothing was actually done because, you prevented all these bad things from happening. So again, I know they're aware, they must be aware of it because the people advising them are aware of it. I don't know what the final result will be. But I do know that, again, look, just reading academic literature and industry publications on regulations, it's very clear that almost everyone working on these issues were trained in Europe or America, and they are very much keeping a pulse on what regulators around the world are doing. So if anything, I would say tech regulators around the world are probably, the most closely connected and constantly talking to each other. I don't know if they'll follow exactly what the others are doing, but they are at least in communication.
Thank you, Ruima. I would like to move a little bit more broadly now and see what kind of considerations we can learn from those remarks that we did about the regulation aspects and what's going on the field with specific cases. In your opinion, what is the general direction of the digital sector in China? And especially for us, because we are sitting in Europe, how China compares to Europe itself and to the US in that sector. You mentioned that tech regulators might speak to each other, but the overall environment we are operating in is also quite different. So what we can learn from what is happening in China, but also what are the lessons that we can get out of it in terms of the approach to the digital economy that is going on over there?
Sure. The digital economy, I would say, so it's a huge part of the government goals, right? Of what the government really wants to improve and advance in China, because the digital economy in China is huge, right? China's e-commerce, for example, just taking one thing is the largest in the world by a pretty big margin. And penetration is very high across multiple technologies, mobile payments, social media, live streaming, etc. And then you have obviously the largest number of internet users in the world over there. One just reached 1 billion, actually. So China has actually in the last decade really went from, you know, not so developed to extremely developed and world leading in terms of everything mobile consumer internet. However, what it still lags behind is enterprise software. And that's where I would say it's going. Enterprise, I would divide it into two things, right? One is businesses in general, but the other part is also government. So there's also a huge push for digital government in China. In fact, that's, you know, because China likes to write everything into goals, 5-year goals and whatever. That's already very explicit. There are these very explicit KPIs about how digitized the government wants to be. On the enterprise front, I would say there is, you know, sort of what you would consider normal enterprise software. So just software that, you know, businesses use as they're doing business. That penetration is actually still pretty low in China, right? So when we're thinking of Chinese tech companies, we're really thinking of Chinese consumer internet companies. There really aren't very many large enterprise software companies. That's still in its infancy in China. It's really only maybe 5 years old. And the other aspect, though, I think that is a little bit different because China has such a large part of the world's manufacturing, right, has almost 30% of the world's manufacturing output. There is the opportunity to digitize the entire manufacturing supply chain in China. And you see that happening as well. So companies working not just on software, but also making smart hardware, especially in factories and reducing energy costs, reducing labor costs. And I think that's a little bit probably unique to China. That's not as much of innovation you'd see in the US, for example, because we don't have as much, you know, manufacturing going on.
Yes, thank you. So I want to go back to this idea of China's push for digital. And you've explained, you know, where we are, e-commerce very advanced, but not government and enterprises. I have a very, very humble question, although I hope it doesn't look offensive, is that if that's the case, so, you know, China not yet leading everywhere in digital, why isn't China opening to the world in this sector? Why is China still so reluctant to open? We just saw a little bit of a small opening on, as you know, internet, so VPN still without control, you know. It's like so slow, or maybe I would argue stagnant, yeah? Why is this the case?
I think for enterprise software, it's actually, at least my understanding is, except for very small, maybe these are not small, but very specific segments of enterprise software, it's not at all close to the rest of the world, right? So there is cybersecurity, which is very, very restricted, right? So I think foreign investors can't even invest in private companies in cybersecurity, but also as long as your data, for example, is stored inside of China, then it's actually not as, it's not that restricted. It's actually less restricted than social media, for example. It's just that the market itself is not very developed. So when you look at the number of small businesses, for example, that are digitized in China, the number, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I just remember it's a much, much lower than the US. And that's just because, again, when you consider how far China has had to come in terms of development, it really only leapfrogged in terms of smartphone usage. In terms of, you know, PC, for example, tech savviness in China, that's still really low compared to the US, right? And China's overall just not even a very educated country. Only about 10% of the people are even university educated. So you have a lot of business operations, especially, you know, aside from basically the top companies, the largest companies, you have it still being very analog and not very digital. And the willingness to pay is very low. So give you an example, the leading enterprise software companies in China right now, there are probably only, as of 2021, right, there are probably only a handful that have $100 million in revenue. That is a drop in the bucket compared to the enterprise software companies you see here in the West, where we have, of course, number one global companies, but even if they're just serving the US market, it is pretty insignificant to get to $100 million in revenue. Whereas in China, you really only have a handful at that range right now. So I would argue that for a lot of software companies, unless you're offering services to the largest companies in China, you don't really have that much of a customer base yet. It's why the Chinese enterprise software companies are really only 5 years old, because it was only 5 years old, 5 years ago that it started making business sense to create these solutions. Now, whether or not, you know, international companies are going to succeed, right? Let's say in areas where it is not restricted, that I don't know, because it is a very competitive market. And, you know, even without restrictions, I would say that businesses in China are run very differently from businesses definitely here in the US, but probably many other countries as well. And so we need a lot of localization. Even Chinese companies, again, have a lot of trouble trying to sell enterprise software. So we'll see if any foreign companies make it. But that is a question I actually get asked a lot. Do I think enterprise software companies are going to make it? And I think it's going to be very, very tough, because it's very tough for even domestic businesses.
Yeah, no, thanks. As a follow-up, I mean, if you take a medium or long term, but a very long term perspective. The talk of the town now is the metaverse. The next big step, the next revolution in tech that will put us on a different dimension. The idea, of course, nobody knows really what the metaverse is. That's why everybody is talking about it. But the idea is like to build a parallel universe in which all of us could be immersed completely in a kind of 3D dimension, but of course at the moment it escapes a definition. But of course, I mean, the companies are investing a lot in it. Facebook is changing its name to stress the fact that, I mean, they are very much into it. But it's not just Facebook; it's all many companies, Google, Microsoft. Everybody is thinking about it. No, so my question is, at the moment, as we were just saying, I mean, we see a separation in the digital universes. I mean, somebody uses the term splinternet to underline the difference, the balkanization, let's say, of the different regulatory framework concerning the internet space, which is also due to different national approaches. So my question is, even it's very difficult, of course, because we don't know what is going to happen. But I mean, like, what do you think is, from this perspective, is going to happen in the next step? I mean, will we see like a split reverse, something like that, in the future, like a complete different metaverse in China, in Europe, in the US, or maybe it's going to be an opportunity for convergence?
You know, I'm a globalist and I would love to see convergence, but I am very doubtful that will happen, at least at this current stage of development. I don't really see how that's going to happen except on a very limited basis, right? So, but if it's like this true metaverse experience where people are actually like living their lives in this environment, and as you said, in a way that currently defies explanation, but yeah, supposing it is as impactful as we expect it to be, then I'm highly skeptical that with the, you know, current environment that it will be this completely unfettered space with, you know, no boundaries. Unfortunately, I'd be curious what the rest of you think, because maybe I'm being pessimistic, but I'd like to think I'm just being realistic.
Well, my first reaction was more if I turn around the question of Mario into a more negative or like pessimistic scenario, as you said, do you then think that we are heading to? I mean, we speak about decoupling more and more when we speak about trade, when we speak about the geopolitical situations. Do you think that we, in the tech area, we are heading towards a decoupling? So exactly the opposite situation where we are going to have a completely different system and which is not going to be interconnected at all.
I think that, you know, in terms of the consumer internet, that is entirely possible for certain aspects, right? So I think in terms of physical goods, that is clearly actually more global. For example, and it's being pushed by China, by the way, right? The government, and I think Alibaba specifically now has said, we want to realize 72-hour delivery from China to anywhere in the world. So, and then for, you know, the other aspects of our digital entertainment, then I do think that there's going to be some aspects of crossover, but China does not, at least my understanding of China right now, is that it does not intend to open up, right? So for anything that is media related, I don't see that in the near future there is any reason for the country to really change the status quo, because it's worked really well for the country. So I don't really see too much pressure for it to change. So unfortunately, I think it may be decoupling in that respect. I don't think it's decoupling everywhere though. So I do think the, you know, quote unquote decoupling, the separation, is really only in the you know, specific parts of the supply chain. And it's not really decoupling so much as redundancy there. But in the media aspect, we may see continued you know, so-called decoupling.
Thank you, Rima. We are going towards the end of this episode, but I would like to hear from Alicia if there are some additional reflections that we can make out of what we just heard, especially more on the macroeconomic side, on the global side. Which are the impacts of all this into the rest of the analysis that we are currently doing when we look at China?
Thank you, Giuseppe. I just wanted to add to Rima's a vision of the kind of selective decoupling, as the FT put it very bluntly, that I quite agree with that. And I would argue that data is really at the core of this selective decoupling, as we saw very clearly with Didi. And I think it's overall one of the key reasons for the crackdown that we started with. So I just wanted to highlight that it might not be everywhere, but it's clearly on the data, cross-border use of data. And the last thing I wanted to add, because this is going to be a seminar, Giuseppe, that we're going to organize at Bruegel on the role of the private sector, which we haven't discussed here. But I just wanted to add that note that when we look at the both the antitrust, which, by the way, we have a new law, Rima, on the draft form in China, and it does look as, I would say, general and therefore open to, you know, discretionary use, if I may say, as it was before. When we add to what has happened already on the focus on the private sector, on this regulatory crackdown, I just worry about that antitrust law not being more specific for the future of the private sector in China. And I just wanted to leave that question open. We may not have time to answer. We hope we can deal with it during our seminar in early December. But I think it's a very important point because the crackdown has been quite biased, or at least quite focused, maybe not biased, on the private sector in China. And that's something that I think deserves attention as well. That's all from my side.
Thank you, Alicia. And Ruima, perhaps really a last word from your side for our listeners. I think that our conversation with you was extremely interesting. And as Alicia said, there are much more things which we couldn't really touch during our conversation today, but that we are keeping monitoring and analyzing here at Bruegel, either with seminars or our podcast and our newsletter and our articles and our publications. So perhaps if there would be like just one additional final remark that you might feel we didn't have the opportunity to touch, but it's extremely important for you at this stage to mention, knowing that we are going to keep this conversation alive and we are going to keep speaking and perhaps hopefully have you again as a guest here at the Sound of Economics.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the last thing I would add is, again, I'm only really familiar with tech, not as familiar at all with many other sectors in Chinese economy. But even in tech, what I see is that the government will try things and then, you know, they will put out these rules. And if it doesn't work, they will actually take it back. So sometimes, you know, we're worrying about what is the impact of this rule? They have gone overboard. You know, this is really bad for the economy or for entrepreneurship or innovation and whatnot. Well, they've made these mistakes before. And I think for the most part, they've corrected the most grave errors. So for those who are trying to bet on the Chinese economy, I think that's one thing you need to keep in mind as well, that, you know, again, these are regulations, yes, and they are, yes, in a sense set in stone, but they can also be reversed if they do not have the intended consequences. And that's why I always say, try to understand the intended consequences and try to understand the ultimate KPIs or results that people are trying to get, because if it doesn't yield the results the government wants, more likely than not, they'll actually just change it. So,
thank you. Thank you so much for this. And we, as I say, we could discuss all this for much longer, but we will have to wrap it up. And that's all the time we have. So this brings us to the end of this episode, which was part of Bruegel's focus on global China seen from Europe, which includes as well a new monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Ruima, Alicia, Mario, thanks a lot for joining the conversation. And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.